Welcome to the podcast edition of American Warrior Radio with Ben Bueller Garcia, presented by Medicare Mentors. American Warrior Radio, telling the stories of the American men and women who protect us at home and abroad. And now, here is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia.
We all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. BBG sitting here in the command seat today. Every American is familiar with the 1836 Battle of the Alamo, where a couple of hundred defenders faced and eventually were wiped out by a Mexican force numbering nearly 2,000. The Siege of the Alamo has become the stuff of legend and was pivotal in leading to the creation of the Republic of Texas. On September 11, 2012, in Benghazi, Libya, another Alamo-like event could have played out. Many of the factors were the same, an area still roiling in revolution, two very small compounds surrounded by numerically larger forces. But Benghazi did not turn into another Alamo thanks to the skill, tenacity, and straight-up courage of a handful of men. The core of the cadre of warriors that defended the annex in Benghazi and the consulate belonged to the CIA Global Response Staff, a special group that was largely unknown to the public up until that day. They took some casualties, but they saved far, far many more lives. Thanks to our friends at Bravo 748 Military and Combat Speakers Bureau, one of them joined us on American Warrior today. Now, I will not go so far as comparing today's guest to Jim Bowie. You can probably figure it out. I never met Jim Bowie, and up until today, I had never met Tig Tegan. But I reserve the right to make that comparison once today's conversation is done. So without further ado, welcome to American Warrior Radio, John Tig Tegan.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, John, I tell you, I have been trying to get someone like you on the show for 5 years now, so I'm very grateful to Jamie and Bravo 748. My understanding is among the Benghazi warriors, you are also very selective about who you speak with, so thanks for that, sir.
Oh, yeah. Thank you again.
Okay. Well, let's start. Let's introduce our listeners to Tig. Your path to becoming a warrior is somewhat interesting, Tig. I've never spoken with anyone inspired to join the Marines by watching the movie Full Metal Jacket.
Well, there's quite a few Marines out there that got inspired by that movie.
Okay, well, I stand corrected. Now, the way you actually got in, I think, has kind of made me chuckle a little bit, being somewhat of a delinquent myself in high school. Apparently, Tig, you were one of the few young people with a cell phone, and you're sitting there in a class, phone rings, it's the recruiters, and you said, I'm done. Got up and left.
Yeah, I did the delayed entry program. So, you know, pretty much a year before I actually went in, I was, you know, not really a Marine, but on the delayed entry program. And yeah, I was in there. It was just before Thanksgiving, and the recruiter called me up and said, "Hey, when do you want to go to boot camp?" And I said, "When do you need me?" And of course, the teacher, he's yelling at me to get off the phone. And I said, "Well," he said, "How about next Thursday?" And of course, and I was just like, okay, I'll come down. I'll be seeing a few minutes. And that was the last time I was in school. Well, in high school, anyways.
Wow. So,
I had my GED prior to that because I wanted to get a job. And so you had to either have a high school diploma or a GED for this job. So I went and got my GED so I could have it. And so that's really the only reason why I actually got in the Marine Corps, because I already had my GED.
Well, I can't imagine the look on the faces of the other kids when you just got up and marched out.
Yeah, and then when I came back about 3 months later and ran to that teacher, he's like, "Where the hell did you go?" And I was like, "Oh, I went to boot camp."
just like that. Now, so you went on to the Marines. You served 4 years with the 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, India Company. Your wife was also a member of the military, correct, Tig?
Yeah, she's not perfect because, you know, she was in the Army, so, you know.
I hope she's not listening.
I say it all the time.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, she joined the Army, and just as I was getting ready to get out, she went in, and yeah, so I got to be a dependent for 4 years.
Well, that's not too bad, I would guess. But my main point there is really it was, as I understand it, her service in the Army, and particularly where she was deployed to, that sort of led you down the path of starting your career as an independent contractor with the private security firms, correct?
Yep. She got stationed at Camp Doha in Kuwait, and there's a company called CSA that was there, and they're kind of like a KBR company. And before she came back home, she got all the contacts, and we sent them our resume and stuff like that. And we both went back July of 2003 and started contracting.
And I'm assuming this is before you had children.
Oh yeah, way before.
Okay. Now, one of the, I try and pride myself on doing my prep before the show. One of the things, Tig, that really made me chuckle, you were doing an interview and you're talking about the distinction between your time in the military and what it's like to be a private contractor, fulfilling much of the same role, but just not wearing a uniform. And your quote was, "The military could take a hot dog eating contest and make it horrible."
Yeah, they can.
So really, up until the September 11th experience, I mean, that for you and some of your counterparts, independent contracting was a pretty good gig.
I mean, yeah, it was. You know, you don't hear a lot of the stuff, that goes on, especially with who I was working for, mm-hmm. So, I mean, a lot of people think that, the six of us that were there, this was the only time anything's ever happened. Well, I did it for 10 years. There's a lot of other rodeos that went on before that one. But I enjoyed it. I was keeping pretty much the enemy off of our back porch, keeping them in their backyard versus ours. So, and it was, I enjoyed it a lot. It was a lot of fun.
Well, we always want it to be an away game, if at all possible. Are you able to share with us, Tig, where, I know you probably can't share much, but, kind of some of the regions that you were involved in or went to during your time in the prior to Benghazi?
With Blackwater, it was mainly, I was with over in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's pretty much the main spots. So out of the 10 years, I probably spent about 6.5 years actually on the ground overseas. So I was pretty much all over the place out there.
Were you ever in Djibouti? Yeah.
Nope, never made it to Djibouti.
I don't really care. I just like the opportunity to say Djibouti on the air.
I know. You can't only say it one time either. You gotta just say Djibouti.
So Tig, as I understand it, that the global response staff of the CIA, the recruitment for that is, I'm guessing they don't take an ad out with one of our sponsors. It's mostly word of mouth. Is from what I understand it. How did you go from Blackwater to the CIA?
Just being overseas and being able to talk with some of the other guys that were there and, find out, what they're doing and stuff like that. And, you kind of, it's not too hard to figure it out when they say, well, I can't tell you who I work for. Mm-hmm. So, okay, and now I know who you work for.
Yeah.
So, and that's just kind of how I found out about it and just kind of weaseled my way because, GRS, you're supposed to have 8 years special forces and, I was only a 4-year Marine. So, but they told me I couldn't do it. And I was like, well, I think I can, I just bugged them enough where they finally said, okay, fine, go try out. If you make it, you make it. If you don't, then shut up and leave us alone. What? That's fair.
Explain to me as a dumb civilian, what on earth does a tryout for the CIA look like?
It's a lot of shooting. You do a lot of housework because, you're not a direct action guy, so you're not going in and kicking doors and finding the bad guys. You're going there pretty much to do, like, rescue missions. Like, if you're the guy you're protecting, something happens to him, he gets kidnapped, so you got to be able to, go through a house. So you and the guy, you're doing in a pair, you're kind of doing SWAT stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have a whole entire backup. Usually it's either you're by yourself or you're with another guy. And so it's a lot of house clearing and stuff like that, a lot of vehicle drills. So, like, you're dismounting the vehicle when you're being under attack. And, they judge you on everything, your weapon handling, are you doing everything correctly and, your speed and stuff like that. So it's pretty intense, very physical.
Okay. So in terms, before we take our first break, take in terms that you can share, that you're allowed to share, and in terms that civilians will understand, briefly describe the role of the GRS, the Global Response Staff Force. What is your generally your mission when you're, well, I guess I suppose sure. You could do it on the home front as well, but mostly overseas.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but all it is, you're doing providing a personal protection for individuals. You know, just kind of like you're a bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easiest way to say it. I mean, you're a bodyguard with some good equipment.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the easiest way to say it. I mean, I think civilians understand that portion of it. And, you know, you're just there to get the guy from location to location in a safe manner.
Okay, and I assume with the critical component being low key as much as possible.
Oh yeah, definitely gotta be low key.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. We're very, very proud to be joined by John Teagan. When we come back, we'll talk about laying some groundwork of the famous attack in Benghazi on September 11th. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm extremely, extremely flattered and proud to be joined live on the phone by John Teagan. You probably recognize his name if you read the book 13 Hours or saw the film 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. John was part of a literally handful of special operators that saved many lives that day in Benghazi on September 11, 2012. Teagan, I'd like to sort of lay the groundwork for that day. You were the most experienced member of the security team there at the annex. You'd had four assignments in Libya. In general, my understanding, Tig, though, is the general populace there was happy to have you there. You received pretty warm greetings there in Libya. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, I mean, they would come up, shake our hands. I've had them, buy our food when we're in restaurants and stuff. Cause we didn't always eat on base. We always, went out in town and ate, mm-hmm. the local restaurants and stuff like that. And yeah, it was definitely different than what, Afghanistan and Iraq were. I mean, they're definitely a lot more welcoming in Libya than the other places.
Was it not uncommon to see Americans wandering through the bazaars and driving around and shopping and having coffee there in Benghazi, or did you guys stick out like sore thumbs, even though you probably weren't supposed to?
No, I mean, there was Westerners always down there.
Okay.
Americans weren't really down in Benghazi too much. They're mainly always up in Tripoli. But, like the French and stuff, they're always down there. So, it wasn't too uncommon to see, white people walking around, or Westerners, I should say, walking around. But yeah, I mean, we definitely stood out. I mean, you can mm-hmm. tell, I mean, you can only, hide yourself so much in the open.
Mm-hmm. Now the revolution, the Libyan revolution there against Gaddafi was still only 19 months old. So I'm guessing it was still sort of a sporty place.
It was, when I first went into Benghazi, a lot of the shops were still closed. A lot of the locals were still gone, but it was a slow progress. They were slowly opening up all the shops up, I think there was like only two gas stations that were opened up when I first got there. But towards the end, everything was open. It was really busy. It started to actually really suck because traffic was horrible. not as bad as LA, but it was pretty bad. Cause it was a small little city and the streets ain't very wide and they can't, there's really no traffic rules. So, but yeah, it started getting busy and picking up, and when I first got there, there was a lot of gunfire going on almost constantly. Not really, firefights, but people just celebrating, shooting their guns off. There was a wedding hall pretty close to the annex. Almost every weekend there's a wedding. And they shoot off anti-aircraft guns to celebrate. Wherever they landed, I guess. But eventually, that last trip, they squashed that, so they weren't doing it as much. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it was definitely getting pretty busy towards the end.
Yeah, you often wonder if those folks have figured out what you know, the basics of gravity. I always shake my head when I say, now take my tactical and strategic experience is limited to many hours playing Call of Duty and plotting the most efficient route to the grocery store during rush hour. So I am by no means an expert. You are. It strikes me that the anniversary of September 11th, kind of an important date. Did a warning go out? Was it just a memorandum that was posted? What was going on, you know, a couple of days before the attack there in Benghazi?
Nothing really. You know, if we're there, it's because it's a high threat. So, you know, just because it was September 11th, we didn't, you know, our security level always stayed the same. So it didn't matter if it was a different, you know, the day by day, it just didn't matter to us because we always treated it the same way. But, you know, it didn't feel any different. There was the election, you know, elections was going on. So there's a lot of kidnapping that was, you know, that was going on, assassinations and stuff like that. But just because it was 9/11, nothing really stood out as something was going to happen.
Okay. Now, Tig, you've been to Tucson before. By the way, let's agree that you will never come to Tucson again without checking in with American Warrior Radio. Can we reach that?
I can't guarantee it, but I can, it depends on my timing.
Chew on it. But anyway, so you probably know there's an airfield north of Tucson that was operated by that agency that nobody works for. It was one of the worst kept secrets in town. I mean, everybody knew what was going on at that base. Was it sort of a similar situation with the annex there in Benghazi?
No, not really. Our neighbors thought we were British.
Okay.
So, but you know, the guys over at the consulate, they would always come over to our compound usually like once a week and stuff. So, you know, it was known to our neighbors that, you know, definitely Westerners were there, but they all thought we were British, not Americans. that was kind of good.
That's a whole conversation there, just trying to get past that. When the distance as a crow flies from the annex where you and your team were based to the consulate was about, as I understand, about a mile as a crow flies. You touched on the fact that, you know, streets over there are not like streets here, so you could see it, you could probably hear it, but getting from point A to point B was probably some of a challenge. My understanding is from where you were, though, once this thing kicked off, you could actually see the consulate was on fire, literally.
No, I don't remember seeing the flames from where we were at. We were actually inside the cars when they started the buildings on fire initially. Mm-hmm. But when we got back after we went to the consulate and came back, I remember being in the tower. You know, there's a lot of you could hear people chanting, gunfire going off, and you could actually see the glow, a little bit of the orange kind of, you know, coming up from where the consulate, in the direction where the consulate was. But it didn't really stand out, in the movie, you know, it just like stood out like you could just totally see it. Yeah, it wasn't really like that.
Okay. Well, now how many actual bodies rolled toward the consulate when you finally decided just to go? Was how many of you all together were there, Tig?
There was six guys, GRS guys, and then one linguist, so seven total.
Okay. And you, when you got there, things, I guess chaos is not even a strong enough word to probably describe what you encountered upon arrival?
Yeah, because again, we didn't know who we're going to link up with or if we're going to link up with anybody at all. And, you know, we get there, there's people, you know, right there at the corner, and we didn't know if they were good guys, bad guys. So we kind of, you know, we came out of our vehicles getting ready to shoot just in case, but, you know, end up being friendly. And yeah, they had three militia guys were engaged with the attackers down at the consulate. And, you know, I grabbed the grenade launcher, went up to the corner, lobbed three rounds, and that pretty much dispersed all the attackers. And, you know, I went back, threw the grenade back in the vehicle and grabbed the machine gun, and myself, Roan, and Jack started moving towards the consulate.
Now, most of us, our experience with your, what happened with you and your fellows there is really limited to the film. And you've already alluded to that. And I know that, you know, there's a distinction between entertainment and reality. But you, as I understand it, when you get there, you actually, you yourself entered the consulate building several times trying to find the ambassador?
Yeah. Yep. I got pretty bad, they call it road rash on my lungs. So it took about 6 months for that to heal up.
Okay. And at some point, though, somebody had to make a very hard decision that it was time to bug out and get who you could recover out of there and get back to the annex. It's, you know, looking back on that, Tig, is that a hard decision to make, or your military, you're trained, the decision's made, and bang, you do it?
I mean, it was a hard decision, but the other problem was nobody knew if he was actually still in the consulate. Hmm. Nobody knew if he actually gotten out and took off, or they had kidnapped him before he even showed up. So it was a tough decision. If we'd have known he was inside for sure, we probably would not have really left. We'd have probably tried to just, suppress the counterassault again. Because, you know, we're feeling pretty confident. I mean, we already pushed him off twice now. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure we could have done it a third time if we really had to. So it was a tough decision, but it wasn't all that difficult because, again, we didn't know if he was even in the building.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I've seen in other interviews that you've done, Tig, is you talk about over the course of the evening, you personally actually didn't expend that many rounds. And like I said, when you see the film, it looks like lead's flying every which way. But tell us one of the main, because I've talked to other folks before that said this, the main distinction between how our guys shoot and how the bad guys shoot.
Yeah, I mean, I pick a target, engage the target, and wait for it to pretty much stop shooting because I broke my NODs or my night vision goggles. So I was just shooting at flashes, really. You know, you just kind of aim a little bit to, you know, kind of where the flash is and a little bit to the left because normally, you know, they don't, 90% of them don't put their rifle in the shoulder and shoot. It's usually at their waist when they're shooting because I guess they can't pick the recoil. It kind of hurts their shoulder, I guess. So, you know. And also, as long as they're shooting at you, if they're aiming at you, you're probably going to be okay because, again, they don't aim. They just swing their gun back and forth like the movies. And usually when they're pulling the trigger, it's not aimed at you. You know, somebody shooting at me would probably hit Tonto, you know, which is, you know, 30 yards on the other side of me.
Well, I tell you, I've been hunting with fellows who are the safest place was directly in front of the rifle. They were not, so it's probably one of those same situations.
You went hunting with Dick Cheney?
Touche, well played, well played. When we come back, Tig, I'd like to talk a little bit about what happened there at the annex itself, and then just sort of, I'm curious to get your perspective about your work on the film, and then I want to definitely talk more about what you're doing now. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by John Tig Tegan. Tig was a member of the very small handful of very, very brave and exceptionally well-trained men who defended the consulate and the annex in Benghazi on September 11th, 2012. Tig, just, again, as I said, it's hard for us to wrap our minds around something like this. Many of us have never been shot at or, thankfully, ever shot at someone else, and if we just depend on what we see in the film, that's probably not completely accurate. How many, in addition to your team, Tig, how many, in the movie there's a reference to, you know, a lot of people keep saying, I'm not weapons qualified. How many actual trigger pullers did you have at the annex when the major attacks began?
Everybody there's, technically, they're qualified because you have to be weapons qualified to actually deploy in those areas. But the real shooters, I mean, there was only six of us. I mean, you know, I would say seven, but the team leader really didn't do anything. I mean, he stood on the front porch the whole entire night. So, Titans, there was only really, well, six, and then we had three State Department guys. So, you know, nine guys.
Versus, I mean, I guess we'll never really know how many. I've heard you say that every attack there was, you know, you estimate the UAV was estimated anyway from 20 to 50 to maybe 100 enemies.
That was it was about 50 to 100 guys coming back to counter assault as a second time at the consulate. And I think over when we were being attacked, you know, I think they said it's in between 20 to 30 guys every time attacking us at the annex.
And you like those odds, Tig?
I was fine with it. Again, you know, we know how to shoot, and we, you know, we had the weapon systems. We had tens of thousands of ammo. I mean, we were not going to run out of ammo anytime soon. And, you know, we just got a new espresso machine. Unfortunately, we never got to use it, but so we're ready.
I know it's been. No, I mean, I'm not laughing. I just
no. I got it.
It's wow. I'm glad there's men like you in the world, Tig. That's for sure. So this leads me to. It's my show. I get to say Djibouti. I was hoping to be able to say commies, but we probably won't get to that in your interview. But I also get a really dumb question every show. As an independent contractor, when you go, you mentioned all the ammunition. Are the weapons and the tools and everything there when you show up? How much input do you have as a contractor saying, I want this versus that?
Weapon-wise, none.
Okay.
It's just whatever they you know, what they tested and what they chose for you to have. You can kind of pick your own gear. You can take some of your gear with you, like the body armor, your mag holders, your pistol holster. But you get a chance of getting that stuff stolen in the airport over there, because you know you don't know who's going to be going through your bag. So, but for the most part, everything was already there for you.
Okay, the initial attack appears to have been just sort of a probing attack, and then there were how many more waves of attacks, Tig? Two, three, four?
We had three attacks on the annex, and pretty technically three attacks on the consulate as well. So overall, it was pretty much six attacks total. The first two attacks on the annex, there was only four of us really suppressing the enemy. And, you know, because the other guys couldn't shoot over our heads because of where we were. So they, you know, it was just myself, Oz, Tonto, and Boone that really engaged with the enemy the first two times. And then the last attack, it was just Roan and Oz and Jack. He kind of engaged for a little bit, but again, he couldn't see the guys at all because of the wall. And so it was really just Roan and Oz were pretty much suppressing the third attack, because when the mortars came in, they attacked us from the back wall the same time the mortars hit. But I don't know, we don't know why they stopped moving in on that side, but thank God they did. But yeah.
So and just to clarify for some of our listeners, the battle, if you will, of Benghazi really took place in two locations. There was the initial attack on the consulate. Your team rolled in there, tried to recover the ambassador, and I assume you took some of the State Department folks, and you returned to the annex, correct? And that's where the remainder of the battle took place.
Yeah, the five remaining State Department guys, we got them in the vehicle, and then when the consulate got counter-assaulted, they took off, and you know we stayed back, defended the consulate, and then once we suppressed that one, they're moving back on. That's when we decided, okay, we got to take off. And yeah, we went back to the annex, and yeah, that's where the other three attacks happened.
Now, I think part of the reason, based on, you know, I've watched the movie a couple of times, and in preparing for today's show and our chat, I have watched a lot of other interviews, and I'm getting the impression, probably because you consulted on the film, let's you know, leave credit where credit is due, that there's elements of the film that actually were pretty accurate. For example, Zombieland, that actually was on your flanks, huh?
Yeah, it was on two of our sides. Let's see, with the east and kind of north and east side, pretty much. it didn't look like that in the movie. They had a lot more concealment, I should say. And there's, you know, a little bit more, a couple more buildings and stuff. There's, you know, you got the stockyard that was completely full of sheep. So, but yeah, it was, they did a really good job on recreating that portion. And, you know, the annex, you know, it, that's what the annex looked like. I mean, when we walked on, it was just like, holy cow, it felt like you were right back in Benghazi.
Where did you film?
They filmed it in Malta.
Okay. Okay. I got to ask this question. You, Colorado boy, and one of the, my favorite lines in the movie was the fellow who was playing your character remove his glasses and stares at the security camera and says, I don't know anything about sheep. Did Tig actually say that?
No.
No. Okay. That I knew we'd get to some creative license somewhere and in
but
this.
Yeah, I don't know anything about sheep. I got cows. I know a lot about cows, but yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they're pretty much about the same, you know, they're, it's an animal. But yeah.
Fair enough.
I think Michael Bay asked me, he's like, do you know anything about it? And I said, no. I think that's probably why they put it in the movie.
In general, Tig, did you, I mean, other than the fact that you guys probably didn't get paid a lot from royalties on the film, were you happy with the final product? Do you think it accurately represents what you and your comrades went through?
Yeah, I mean, it did. They did a really good job. You know, we don't get no royalties from the movie at all. As they said, it didn't do good enough. So,
oh, come on.
The same. Yep, same with the book. We don't get no royalties off the book, so... but yeah, they did a good job. It honored the four guys, and you know, it's Hollywood. But it, for I think the accuracy of the movie for Hollywood, it's pretty much 100%. But to me, it overall, I think it's about 60% accurate.
Yeah,
like Roan, you know, he played the role of himself and the team leader, and the chief of base kind of did the same thing. He played the chief of base and the role of the team leader. So, you know, there's a couple things that, you know, got blended together. You know, like Jack, he did a lot of things that I really did over there. Because the reason why Michael Bay did that was just so the movie would flow better instead of bouncing back and forth constantly. So they kind of just focused. The main focus was really on, you know, Roan and Jack's relationship because they're both Navy SEALs. And plus, Michael Bay has a Navy SEAL fetish. So, you know, they made them the two main characters in the movie. But, you know, it is what it is. But our biggest goal was to honor the guys who got killed.
Well, sure, sure. And I got to tell you, to me, one of the more touching, perhaps the most touching part of the film, Tig, was when you did get up to the roof after the mortar attacks and you went to Roan and eventually Bub Doherty, you said a prayer over those two fellows. And if I may add, the prayer went, God watch over him, guide him to where he needs to be, take care of his family. Was that where did that prayer come from? Was that something that had been in your family, Tig, or?
No, it's just something that I just kind of at the spur of the moment.
Okay. At which point, and again, looking at the film, one of the challenges today, particularly in that part of the world, is nobody wears uniforms. You're not quite sure who's a good guy and who's a bad guy until they literally start shooting at you. Was there a point at which you, where the adrenaline stopped pumping, where, okay, we're going to get through this, it's over? Or, I mean, it's my understanding you even had a little bit of a kerfuffle even getting back to the airport as you're evacuating.
Yeah, we didn't relax until we were actually wheels up. Even when we're inside the C-130, we still had our guns right there ready to go just in case. You know, it was pretty much when that plane took off. That was when it kind of relaxed. And then when you landed up in Tripoli, you know, you got to get from the airport back to your compound. So, you know, you're pretty much guns up again and you get to your compound. And then that was pretty much, you know, relaxed time. You know, you went, you took a shower. Actually, we ate, debriefed, went, took a shower, and tried to sleep. It's that, you know, you're just kind of laying there. It's, I mean, it's middle of the day now, and I think it was about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The team leader came around, got us all, said, "Hey, you guys are being evacuated to Germany." So,
Tig, one of the things I've often discussed with guests here on the show, particularly some veterans from previous wars, one of the real distinctions nowadays, and I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing or both, but you know, in World War II, we're invading Normandy, and folks start to hear about it somewhere down the line. in your case, your wife, I'm guessing other spouses, are turning on the TV and seeing something popping off in Benghazi live on CNN. At which point were you able to finally reach out to your wife and say, literally, I'm okay?
We were at the airport, and it was after we got the initial plane gone, you know, pretty much all the non-shooters. So it was in between, I don't know, probably sometime between 9 in the morning and 10 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Do you think she handled it? I mean, it's hard to handle something like that at all, but given that she was actually in the military herself, do you think she was a little better prepared for something like this than some of the other spouses in retrospect?
Yeah, I mean, she didn't know what was going on until I called her, so
oh.
It was pretty easy.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Well, I tell you,
the time I called her, I was letting her know I was safe, just because, you know, we didn't know it was on the news until I think it was Jack's wife ended up getting the hold of him, and that's how we knew it was all over the news. That's when we said, "Oh crap, we need to call our wives."
Surreal. The whole thing.
Otherwise,
is...
we wouldn't call. We probably wouldn't call.
Whole thing is surreal. When we come back, I want to talk a little more with you, Tig, about what you're doing now. And ladies and gentlemen, as long as their names are mentioned, they'll never be forgotten. Glenn Doherty, Tyrone Woods, Ambassador Chris Stevens, and Sean Smith. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by John Tig Teigen. John, or I've been calling you Tig this whole time. I suppose I should ask permission first, huh?
Nah, that's, I'm used to it. I seem to go by that more than I do John nowadays.
Okay, well, you know, I've got on my punch list, Tig, that I'm going to try and get somebody over to Benghazi to recover that espresso machine. And maybe we can get you and your buddies together, and we'll have an espresso together. I think that would be a good deal. Tig, in my day job, I'm an independent contractor, and those folks who've never worked for themselves sometimes don't understand. You know, we touched on the equipment part of it, but you know, you're responsible for your own insurance and a lot of other stuff. I think I saw an interview with one of the spouses. I don't know if it was Glenn's or whose it was that mentioned that he didn't have, there was not a lot in place to take care of the family after he was killed. Was that part of the inspiration or part of the thought process when you and your wife, Margaret, began or established the Beyond the Battlefield Foundation?
Yeah, our foundation pretty much will help veterans and the families out as much as we can. We don't have bylaws that, you know, that say that we can only do this, and I didn't want that. I mean, our main focus is to try to help veterans get service dogs, but, you know, we'll help, you know, do whatever. I mean, we helped bury a World War II veteran. We've helped two out with their homes, so we just do whatever we can for them.
And folks, you can visit the TeiganFoundation.org. That's TEIGEN. Foundation.org. Tell us a little bit more about your mission and some of the programs that you offer to the veterans out there.
You know, we try to help them with TBI, PTS. You know, we work with other foundations, you know, like American Military Family. You know, they help guys out. They put them in, like, hyperbaric chambers and, mm-hmm. you know, SAW, Special Operation Warrior. Save a Warrior. I got so many foundations in my head. They, you know, they help them with counseling and stuff for veterans, and you know, we just partner with these guys. So, you know, it's good with. I wish more veteran groups would get together with other veteran groups, because you can just do so much more and help out so many more guys and a lot faster. So, but you know, we just do whatever we can for them, and we provide. If we can't provide it, we know other foundations or where to go to help them get the help that they need. Mm-hmm. You know, we've even helped the first responders. You know, we've had, you know, first responders, you know, they have PTS, and the problem is they don't really have anywhere to go. So a lot of these other organizations that do veterans, they've actually opened up and started helping out first responders with, you know, PTS and stuff. And it's just a good thing to see these guys get the help that they need. You know, I went through a couple. I'm actually doing the hyperbaric chamber myself for the TBI that I've had, which pretty much kind of, I was diagnosed with it after Benghazi, but never really did anything about it until now. So it's definitely helping out quite a bit.
Yeah, I've seen studies where that is critical, and I wish we had more of those chambers around the country, and you know, particularly here in Tucson and some of these other locations. Tig, what for our listeners, what can they do to help you and your wife and the foundation? I mean, clearly we're at the end of the year. Hey, folks, if you need a tax write-off, go to the TeganFoundation.org and make a donation. But can you use... I mean, are your volunteer opportunities limited to just the region that you're physically located in, Tig? Or
no.
Okay.
No, I mean, right now we need help with setting up, we call them galas or fundraisers. We have, I think, 3 set up for next year. And, you know, the more that we get, you know, obviously the more money we get, the more people we can help. None of our board members are paid. You know, everything that we do, we put right back into the foundation itself. You know, it's really myself, my wife, a guy named Jeff, and it's really the 3 of us that are doing this. And, you know, the biggest thing to help out now is, you know, get the word out. Like you said, you know, we need money. That's the only way we can operate. And, you know, the biggest thing we're doing right now is we're doing pretty much calling it a fire run. We're trying to get toys, school supplies, and gift cards to get out to the kids that were affected by California fires. And, you know, myself and Jeff, we're actually getting a U-Haul. We got a couple of locations in Colorado Springs and Denver, Grand Junction, and Utah, Salt Lake City. Now we're trying to find the locations in, you know, like Marble Falls, headed down towards Vegas. We need to find a location in Vegas. We got some locations in Southern California. We had companies that come on board, you know, Brothers in Arms. They helped out. Car Firearms and Right On Optics and Nine Line Apparel. They jumped on immediately, so they're helping out. But, you know, the more the word gets out, you know, the more, again, toys, school supplies. You know, they definitely, when I called them and asked, what do you guys need, they said, we definitely do not need any clothes. So they got so much clothes up there, it's just stacked in a warehouse now. Because I guess, like, companies like Walmart and Target, they stepped up and, you know, provided all that for them. But, you know, now, you know, the kids, I was looking at my kids, this is how it kind of started. I was looking at them, and I'm starting, you know, the fire was going on, and you see the kids in the tents, I'm thinking, you know, Christmas is coming. Mm-hmm. You know, what are these, you know, the parents, they're worried about how to feed them now, you know, and clothe them and stuff like that. I was like, well, I'll just see what we can do to lighten the load. And so I said, like, you know, let's do this toy drive thing real quick for them to help them out, because I wouldn't want my kids to go without a Christmas. So that's one of the reasons why we started doing it.
Well, Tig, I tell you, it's pretty clear to me that you are definitely a special operator when you say our foundation is me and my wife and a guy named Jeff.
Yeah, we started about, that's going on, it'll be our 2nd year pretty much, so it's, you know, it's a work in progress, but, you know, again, we've helped out, you know, 2 veterans with dogs, and, you know, it's going good.
Well, I tell you what, folks, I love to shoot, and hopefully my wife Laura is listening. Laura, if you are, there is a Tig Tommy gun that is part of his series of firearms for Car Firearms. And if you want to put that on my Christmas list, Laura, that'd be okay. And that's a portion of the proceeds for all those firearms goes to support the foundation, correct, Tig?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yep. Car's been really awesome. You know, they've helped us raise we're up to $140,000 in a year, not for just my foundation, but for 12 different foundations right now. So they've been awesome helping us out, raise money for everybody.
Tig, we're down to about a couple minutes just left in the show. 2 quick questions. One, coming back to Benghazi, you know, 2020 hindsight, do you think that if you had left earlier and if there had been air support, would those 4 men likely still be alive today, or is that?
Oh, not a doubt.
Okay.
You know, because Ambassador Stevens and Sean Smith, they both died of smoke inhalation. If we'd have left immediately, the group wouldn't had a time to set the buildings on fire, because then we would have been engaged with them. Because by then, we're going to go over there to do something. We're not going to go in there and really be quiet. They need to know we're there. They need to know we're coming. So, again, it takes the attention away from the ambassador and puts the attention on us, which that's what our job would have been. And as for Roan and Bub, I mean, that was, you know, mm-hmm. air support would have made a huge difference, because they knew what our air capability was. You know, if they, you know, threw a fast jet over the top, you know, everybody went inside. They would not have been out in the open anymore. And the mortar team, obviously, they have to set up in the open. And, you know, talking to guys who were running a lot of the satellite and stuff like that, you know, they said they, you know, they spotted where the we call them poo sites, where the mortar team was at setting mm-hmm. up and stuff. So they had eyes on where they were.
Wow.
So they would have been able to stop them.
Wow, that's tragic. Tig, anything else our listeners need to hear? I mean, we don't have enough time for all of it.
Yeah. I would just say, you know, Christmas is coming, and, you know, again, help us out, helping these kids, you know, get, you know, have a good Christmas for, you know, as much as we can.
Okay. Thank you so much, sir. I'm really, really proud of what you and your fellow warriors did there. Folks, it's been your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Don't forget to check out Bravo748.com and the Teigen Foundation, TIEGN.com. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures will remain in place.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.
You've been listening to the podcast edition of American Warrior Radio with Ben Bueller Garcia, presented by Medicare Mentors. American Warrior Radio, telling the stories of the American men and women who protect us at home and abroad. American Warrior Radio airs Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KRDO News Radio 105.5 FM, 1240 a.m. and 92.5 FM, and is available by podcast at KRDO.com. Select the radio tab and click on podcasts.